And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have three author interviews for you, and here's the first.
And for this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, I am really excited to be making the acquaintance for the first time with a very talented writer by the name of Mike Johnston. Once an architect, but now a writer of wonderful, entertaining fantasy fiction for young readers. And what I have in hand is a delightful book called Confessions of a Dork Lord, Grave Danger. This is, I think, the second in a series devoted to a young adolescent boy who is sort of wrestling with his own legacy as the son of the so-called Dark Lord, heir to the throne of black and broken glass, supposedly the next leader of the grim world, but wrestling with all that at the tender age of 12. And out of Mike Johnston's rich imagination has come this very detailed and vivid world in which we have the grim folk lands and the fair folk lands, and how do these lands and their various inhabitants understand one another and coexist. It's all absolutely delightful, and I'm excited to be able to speak with Mike Johnston about where all these interesting ideas came for his Confessions of a Dork Lord series, which is published by G.P. Putnam Sons. Mike Johnston, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I'm really excited that we can do this. So let's talk, first of all, about this interesting veer in the road for you professionally. Tell us what you initially intended for your professional life to be, and then tell us what happened to change that.
Yeah. Good question. So I began as an architect. I studied architecture. I have a master's from Columbia, and I lived in New York City and worked as an architect for quite a few years before moving to Los Angeles and also practicing architecture here. So I love architecture. It was kind of something that will probably always be a part of me, but I also love books. And maybe that was my first love when I was a kid. I think I discovered fantasy and science fiction at a very young age and spent probably an inordinate amount of time with it, with reading. And so it's something that I've always felt comfortable with and loved. And I think as I grew older and as I experienced the profession in the world, I found that I loved architecture. I didn't love the profession of architecture. Sometimes practice is different from the thing you learn about in school. And so I found myself seeking creative outlets, and books were that other thing that I loved. And the other thing I wanted to explore. So I started working on it like anybody else, probably part-time. There's a long sort of transition between the two for me. And I've written, kids weren't my first venture into writing. I've also written for adults. I have a epic fantasy series called The Amber Throne, first book, Solari, that debuted from Tor Books. And this kid's book actually came out of that experience. I was writing kind of very detailed, historic fiction for adults, and I wanted to do something a little bit different. And I had a young kid, and I was reading to her a lot and kind of seeing what made her laugh and what got her excited. And I thought, I could probably do that. And it would be a nice kind of antidote to like the seriousness of my adult fiction. I could do something really kind of short form and fun and humorous. So I write two very different styles, and I find that refreshing. That's kind of how I started in books.
Yeah. So I think a lot of people from the outside looking in would carelessly assume that it is a lot easier to write this kind of a book than to write the denser, more detailed adult fantasy fiction that you were describing earlier. And I suspect that maybe in some ways it's true, but I suspect in other ways this is rife with challenges all its own. What are the challenges of writing effectively for young readers, specifically ages 8 to 12.
Yeah, I think we fool ourselves in thinking that kids are easy or unsophisticated compared to adults. And of course, we know that's false. Kids are demanding. And, for the first book, I was able to tour and visit middle schools and elementary schools too, prior to the pandemic. So, when you step out in front of an audience of 200 or 300 kids, you have to be funny and interesting fast. Like, adults will give you time. Kids will not. And books are the same way. Like, your book has to be engaging, and it has to be engaging on the first page in a way that, you know, some of the adult books I like take, you know, 50, 100 pages to get going, sometimes less. But, you know, adults are willing to give you time to develop a plot and a story and a character in a way that kids are not. You know, kids are ruthless. You have to give them something interesting on the first sentence or you're going to lose them. So there are challenges with kids and with adults, and they're different. You know, the adult books do take more time. I spent 2 years on each of my adult books, which is probably like four times how long it takes to write one of the kids' books. So there are definitely challenges with adult books that don't exist in kids' books, but it would be naive to think that kids aren't really sophisticated and really demanding.
Right. We're speaking with Mike Johnston about his new series of book called Confessions of a Dork Lord. And the second book in the series has just come out called Confessions of a Dork Lord, Grave Danger. So describe, Mike Johnston, to our listeners, the world that you have created in which this young man, your main character, exists.
Well, it's a fantasy story, and it's a little like a lot of fantasy stories we've known. We've got a kid in magic school like Harry Potter. We've got a big fantasy world with orcs and goblins and knights and elves like Lord of the Rings. But, you know, I've kind of tweaked the story a little bit to make it new and maybe a little bit fresh. So our hero is the son of the Dark Lord. Now, who's the Dark Lord? It's sort of the big baddie, the Sauron of Lord of the Rings, the Voldemort of Harry Potter. He's the son of the bad guy, and he's expected to follow in his father's sort of grim footsteps, but he isn't sure he's up to the task, isn't sure he wants to follow in his dad's footsteps. He's got limitations. He's kind of allergic to the whole fire and brimstone thing. He isn't sure he wants to be his dad, but everyone wants him to follow in his footsteps. So we kind of see that classic tension of expectations from adults placed upon a child, and how he will deal with them and how he will assert his own personality and his individuality, you know, when faced with, you know, outside expectations for who he'll be. That's a tough situation. So I deal with it with a lot of humor, because that's how kids can deal with life.
Right. As you have constructed this world and the characters within it, how meticulous have you been with all of the details? In terms of like how the magic works, who can do magic, what is the nature of that magic, and so on. I think some people craft these books in a sense rather loosely, and others really feel like they want to create a fairly firm matrix or framework within which these characters live and breathe.
Yeah, you know, when I write for adults, the world and the systems are a little bit more airtight, watertight. You know, you can't have leaks in the whole thing, or the adults will pick it apart. But, you know, for the kids, I'm a little more flexible because I think the story and the world building have to be in service of the humor. Like, these are funny books, and they sort of take all the fantasy tropes and mock them. There's funny spell books, and there's funny spells. There's spell books that'll teach you how, you know, to make desserts dance, and the spells do funny things, the characters do funny things. So I'm willing to bend the rules here and there with the kids' book a little bit, as long as it's believable for the sake of a good joke. Because I'm trying to make readers out of the kids, and I want to entertain them. I want them to have a lot of fun and still have something that's smart. But these are fun books.
So towards the beginning of this newest book, Confessions of a Dork Lord, Grave Danger, the Dork Lord, the young boy who is your main character, is trying to create some excitement, generate some attention for himself by doing a really big spell. And if I remember correctly, he's actually only done one spell correctly. So yeah. In this world, apparently the young magicians start out very, very slowly and very, very carefully. But he's trying to do something kind of outrageous and above himself. And it actually ends up being, thanks to a really interesting misunderstanding over a hominin, that in fact his spell has a very different effect from what's intended. Describe to our listeners what I'm talking about.
So He's in magic school, which we all kind of know from Harry Potter and the million other kind of, you know, magic schools we visited in fantasy over the years. But it's not like Harry Potter. He's not immediately good at magic or inherently talented. And yes, in the first book, he's never even cast a magical spell. And by the end, he's only cast one. And so as the second book opens, he's trying to cast a second. He just kept cast two spells in his whole life. And he unfortunately hears about a really powerful spell, a spell that's way beyond his ability, something for older kids. And so he asks about it. He learns the spell and attempts to cast it, trying to impress his peers, and maybe doing something he shouldn't, maybe stretching his ability beyond what he should. And he causes a sort of grave calamity. He destroys literally the castle with the throne room, the castle that he is supposed to one day rule from, he destroys. And his blunder is so bad, he finds himself kicked out of his own castle, the guy who's one day supposed to rule it, and forced to live with his mortal enemies, which is us, the humans, basically. So this is kind of a story about turning like some of the fantasy tropes on their head. I've kept going with that second book. So it's a fun exploration about learning who you are and maybe learning about who we think are our enemies and maybe they aren't.
Right, exactly. I guess that's one of the best abiding themes in the book is the way in which this young boy has his assumptions very much upended, and it kind of happens over and over again, and it's really, really enduring. It's fair to say that this is also a book about unlikely friendships.
I think so. Yeah, that's a great observation. It is a book about essentially what he's forced to live with his enemy. They're the bad guys, the orcs, the goblins, the dragons. That's what Wick represents, our hero. And they're just kind of the good guys, the knights, wizards, and elves. I've taken some of these cliches, some of these tropes from fantasy, and I'm kind of playing with them and turning them on the head and trying to make them new and interesting. So he goes off to live with the good guys, which, because they're the bad guys, they see the good guys as the bad guys. So he's really going to live with the bad guys, which is us, the humans. And he thinks this guy should be his enemy. He thinks he should be this terrible person, but he discovers a friend in them. So it's a little bit about real life and how we sometimes have expectations about people who are different from us. And those expectations aren't necessarily true when we actually meet these people. And as you said, yes, that's something that kind of keeps happening to them over and over. So it's, you know, it's about coming of age and learning who you are and learning how to act around other people who are different.
You mentioned that you have a young child, and I don't know what age they are, but were they a literal sounding board for you as this book was taking shape? I mean, would you try out certain things to see how it went over, or did you wait until you had a finished product to share with them?
Yeah, no doubt. You know, my daughter's 15 now, but she's probably 9-ish when I started writing this series, 10. So she was kind of like a prime middle grade reader. And that really was, I think, as I may have said earlier, kind of the genesis of this story. You know, just she was kind of my first test audience as I read to her, you know, great fantasy books for kids like Cornelia Funke or Neil Gaiman, you know, just really seeing what she reacted to, what made her laugh, which stories engaged her, kind of formed the backbone for this series. Like, it was a sort of test market of one, you know, and I kind of got a good feeling. I know what I liked as a kid, but, you know, that was a long time ago. It was interesting to see what caught her attention now and what, you know, drew her into the narrative. And, you know, without a doubt, you know, I found that, you know, it was the humor that drew her into the book. And, you know, when you write for kids, this is when kids discover books and when they learn to be lifelong readers. So you really want to find ways to draw them in and have them fall in love with books the way we did when we were kids. And so that's kind of how I settled on humor, because it seemed like that was the perfect bridge. That was what drew her into the story.
What about when it comes to writing for younger readers? What kinds of things, aside from, of course, it needs to be funny and it needs to be exciting, but beyond that, I mean, there are plenty of funny and exciting books that, of course, would not be at all right for young readers. I think a lot of us, again, from the outside looking in, assume that it's mostly about keeping the sentences short and the paragraphs short and the words simple and so on. And I'm sure there is actually much more to it, and maybe those matters aren't involved at all in terms of writing effectively for young readers just in general. What are the things you think about most as you are confronting the blank page and want to write something that a young reader is going to enjoy beyond the basics of making it funny and exciting?
Yeah, you know, I was rereading Watership Down, and the author said that he couldn't sell it initially because the editor said, well, it's written like an adult book with long sentences, but it's about rabbits, so adults aren't going to read it. And kids aren't going to read it because they might like a book about rabbits, but they're not going to read a book with long sentences and careful writing. So as we all know, that's a classic. It's a great book. So, our conception of what is good or what goes into a kid's book isn't necessarily always true. And sometimes you can make a classic by bending those rules. I think you're absolutely right. I do, in general, try to keep things moving more quickly. Yeah, shorter sentences, shorter chapters. I can do it when I write for adults. I can do a 20-page chapter. That's no problem. I think it would be a disaster to put a 20-25-page chapter in a kid's book, especially when these books are 200 pages long. I do think like the 2-3-page chapter, maybe 4-5 tops is kind of the limit. So yeah, and there are real structural things. I think if you can bend them here and there. So these aren't hard and fast rules. I do think being quick and being entertaining is important for kids. There probably is, when I was a kid, I had no problem reading something like Dune that takes 100 pages to get going. I don't know that kids today have that attention span. That seems, and I might be wrong, and I'd be happy to be proved wrong. But I do feel like maybe you have to move to the point a little bit more quickly. And so I have definitely found that when I do kids lit, and even adult lit sometimes lately, it has to hit in the first sentence, and then you have to establish your plot in the first chapter. There are some rules, but they're not hard and fast.
Well, I think you've written a wonderful book here that I, for one, really enjoyed. I'm 62 years old, but
I like it too.
A lot of young people enjoying this very much as well. It's the second book in the series, Confessions of a Dork Lord. The second book is called Grave Danger, and it's published by G.P. Putnam and Sons. And the author, Mike Johnston. Mike Johnston, I congratulate you on a really wonderful book, and what a pleasure to speak with you about it on The Morning Show. Thank you so much, and happy writing in the years to come.
Thank you so much for having me. Thanks.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And I am so grateful to be able to have a few minutes to speak with Sonia Manzano, who is beloved to many for her part of Sesame Street for many years, with the beloved character Maria, but also the author of a number of wonderful books, including a memoir, Becoming Maria, Love and Chaos in the South Bronx. Her most recent book, her first book for National Geographic, is called A World Together. And this is a book that the world really needs. And it is a beautiful exploration of just what makes our world so beautiful and rich, and how in our diversity we find layers of beauty that we would otherwise never be able to see. And we have a couple of minutes to speak with Sonia Manzano about what inspired her to write this book, A World Together. Sonia Manzano, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, thank you so much. My pleasure to talk about the book. I jumped at the chance when National Geographic asked me to write a book about diversity, seeing as a state we find the world in today, and especially our country. I'm especially chagrined of the state of affairs, since I thought that Sesame Street had sort of solved all those problems in 1969 and the result of the civil rights movement and the idealism of President Johnson when he wanted to create the Great Society way back in the 70s. So if there's one thing I've learned, it's that just because you address a problem in one generation doesn't mean it's going to spill over into the coming generation. Mm. So it was time for a good book about sharing all the ways that we are the same, in that we feel sad and we feel happy and we all want shelter and we all feel hungry and we all are satisfied when we eat something good, are all the ways that we're the same part of the human condition. The only ways we're different is culturally, and those are the cultural things we should celebrate.
Hmm. So explain to our listeners what they find in the pages of this book, both in your words, your lovingly crafted words, but also in the splendid visuals that are also part of this book.
Yes, Laurie Epstein, the photo editor at National Geographic, did a smashing, wonderful job of showing all kinds of kids in all kinds of situations. I wanted some urban images, and she complied by having that wonderful image of the kids playing by a fire hydrant, because that was kind of my experience as a kid growing up in the Bronx. And I was also interested in not shying away from showing a sad image, and we have a picture of a looks like a soldier kissing his child goodbye, and the words that go with it say, "And when people feel scared, they sometimes forget that deep down we're all the same." Mm-hmm. And I suppose I'm reacting to the fact that I see so much anger out there more than I thought people felt, but clearly they do. And that must come out of fear, and we forget that we're the same. And that picture, coupled with those words, might inspire conversations in that direction or not. Or someone will just say, well, that's like just a sad picture and leave it at that. So I hope it is a book that starts when you close the last page.
Mm. What do you think it is that keeps some people from embracing and celebrating this notion of our diversity? What is it that makes that, to some people, an idea that they just don't warm up to and maybe even feel even kind of repelled by or afraid of? What are people afraid of when it comes to diversity?
I don't know why people are afraid. I honestly don't, and I was struck by a quote. I want to say it was Carrie Mae Weems, but I don't know if she said that, an African-American artist. If it wasn't her, I apologize, but who said, "I look and I look and I look in the mirror, but I don't see. What is so frightening?" And those words stay with me. And, you know, I do a voice on an animated show for Nickelodeon where I play a Mexican grandmother. Now, it's very funny. I enjoy myself because they keep correcting my Puerto Rican Spanish. Because it's a little different. It's a little different. And the foods, you know, I'll have to pronounce foods that begin with the letter X. And I don't know how to pronounce them. So they'll help me with the pronunciation. But that doesn't frighten me that they're different. I enjoy it. It doesn't frighten me when I read Sherman Alexie books and I learn about Native American experience. It's curious. It's different from mine. It's when I read about a poor child on a reservation. I was a poor child in the Bronx, but they're very different experiences. And it just... I'm curious about it, not frightened. Hmm. I don't know why some people find any change in anyone's lifestyle or behavior so frightening. I'm at a loss.
In the last 20 seconds, what did you learn from all of your work on Sesame Street that helped you understand and appreciate diversity?
Humor. Humor will go very, very far. People will laugh at the same things. And I think that's why Sesame Street is such a success worldwide, because people will have a sense of humor and usually find the same things universally humorous.
Funny how laughter opens up the heart. And I love your book, A World Together, published by National Geographic. Sonia Manzano, thank you for giving it to the world.
Thank you so much. Stay well.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Now for a fun interview that comes from The Morning Show archives. This interview dates all the way back to 2004. And I'm very excited that for the next few minutes here on The Morning Show, that I can speak with one of the most important authors of
of young people's fiction slash fantasy. His name is Jonathan Stroud. He is an English writer who is highly acclaimed for a number of different works to his credit, and in particular for a series of books which are called the Bartimaeus Trilogy. The second book has just come out called The Gollum's Eye. And in these richly written books, we follow the exploits of a young man by the name of Nathaniel, who is able to wield some of the wonders of magic. And it is a very, very beautifully written book, which I have thoroughly enjoyed. It makes me want to investigate the first book in the trilogy for myself. And we're going to be speaking with Jonathan Stroud about how he has found himself in this particular arena, writing for young people, and maybe some of the special challenges which are involved in doing so. Jonathan Stroud, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks so much, Greg. Good to be here.
Let's get that first question out of the way. I imagine you're tired of being asked it, but how is it that you find yourself applying your considerable talents to this particular audience?
Well, I started out, after I left college, I started out as an editor of children's books at a London publishing house. Through that, I began to write young books for kids, puzzle books and things of that sort. And gradually, I began to write novels too, but it was always for a younger audience. I think partly it's because to write for children, you've got to have a very good story, a good narrative to hold their attention, and stories with magic and with fantasy were always areas that I was interested in as a child myself, so I naturally gravitated towards that area.
There are a couple of books out that at least generally are of this same ilk, including a few which have sold quite a few copies that will remain nameless.
Yes, quite.
But here's another question I'm sure that you're weary of answering after all this time. But in what way have you tried to stake out for yourself, at least in some respects, something new and fresh in the midst of other people that have really just pretty much copied a certain phenomenon?
For sure. You're absolutely right. I mean, there's no point doing it unless you create something that has its own freshness and its own voice. That the idea that that I had for the Bartimaeus trilogy is that in a way the central protagonist is in fact Bartimaeus, who's a genie and not a human at all. There are human characters, there are magicians, but most of the magicians are actually very corrupt and not at all heroic or admirable. And the audience, I think, generally speaking, identifies with this totally non-human, 5,000-year-old, sarcastic genie, who's the most, by far and away, the most charismatic character in the book. And by turning a lot of the conventions on its head, so that you don't identify with the humans or the magicians, I think it is possible to have got quite a lot of fun with the conventions of the fantasy genre.
Well, and what's interesting is you set up a scenario, for instance, in this current book where Nathaniel, because of a really kind of frightening attack by some sort of distant enemy, really is sort of forced to call upon the genie Bartimaeus for aid, and doesn't particularly want to, just realizing that this is something kind of unpredictable.
That's absolutely right. And in the first book of the trilogy too, The Amulet of Samarkand, you have this the central thing around which the whole story revolves is the relationship between Nathaniel and Bartimaeus. And essentially, it's a very tense relationship. Neither of them likes the other. When Bartimaeus is summoned by Nathaniel, he is basically his slave. He has to obey what Nathaniel says. So Bartimaeus resents this greatly. Nathaniel, for his part, is scared of what Bartimaeus might do to him, because Bartimaeus obviously has many powers, and he has to make very, very sure that he keeps the genie at a distance. So you have this quite entertaining but very tense relationship at the core of the book.
Mm. Do I remember correctly that it opens in Prague, the city of Prague?
It does, yes. Book two definitely does, yes.
With Nathaniel sort of checking on the defenses surrounding the city, and as he walks around, he's seeing kind of a wild, crazy quilt of different beings. And I guess what's kind of interesting, and maybe unlike many fantasy books, is that as you've already alluded to, not every not every mythical being or mystical being here is formidable. I mean, some of them are kind of funny looking and don't exactly know what they're doing, and that's what also gives this story some of its unpredictability and texture.
Yes, that's right. There's a lot of hierarchy in the book, and there's hierarchy among the humans, the magicians. There's the Prime Minister of Britain is a magician, and his ministers are magicians, and Nathaniel, who's this young apprentice, essentially is working his way up the political greasy pole. But as you say, there's a lot of humour to be had from the hierarchy among the supernatural creatures too. And Bartimaeus is pretty much a middle ranking genie, and he likes to think of himself as being pretty much top dog. He's pretty formidable, but as it makes clear as he goes through it that there are plenty of imps who are less powerful than him, but there are also plenty of frits and other creatures who are far more powerful. So he has to use his wits as well as his magical abilities to survive.
He has been appointed to something called the Office of Internal Affairs.
Yeah,
and that's kind of an interesting presence in a book like this. I mean, particularly when you think about, you know, a 12-year-old taking it in hand. Tell us about that and how that kind of image can figure so well in a story like this.
Well, I think a lot of fantasies over the years have often been quite simplistic in their approach towards good and evil. You tend to have the good guys against the bad guys, and it's quite an absolute thing, good versus evil. In what I try to do here is that most of the characters in the book, certainly Nathaniel the kid and Bartimaeus the genie, are quite ambivalent. Morally, they're a bit ambivalent. They've got good elements, but they also have kind of bad impulses too. And this is kind of reflected in the fact that it's quite a political book in some ways. Their story is encased in a very political world with people trying to gain power and to retain it. And down below them, you've got the ordinary people, the commoners, who have no magical ability at all and have no power. And what was fun for me was creating a story which has all the usual magic and chases and fights and you know, nice monsters, but setting it in a rather more astringent political environment, and the two things rather nicely mingle, I think. Fantasies often can be kind of quite feel good and a bit fluffy, and I think it's nice to put it in a slightly more somber political world.
Mm. One of the challenges facing Nathaniel is that he is trying to investigate some sort of powerful being that has been attacking London. Mm. And I guess is that what sends him to Prague?
That's right. Yes, he has to track down the source of the person who sent this magical being to London. And Prague, which was the previous kind of magical empire in Europe, there were plenty of magicians there who might well have done the deed. So he and Bartimaeus go back to Prague to try and track him down.
Mm. One of the things I really do like about this book is that you have obviously worked out all kinds of specifics in your mind about the magic which is going to be wielded in this trilogy. And I mean, as though you have assembled in your head, and maybe you've even laid it down on paper, a complex series of rules about how the magic works, what works and what doesn't, what different kinds of attacks there are. And,
yes.
I mean, and I don't know that every author that writes in this field is always that careful with the details, details that I'm sure begin to really matter to your devoted readers.
Oh, they really do. And in fact, as I've been touring around America now, I've been getting very young readers, sometimes as young as 9 and 10, who sit there in front of me and actually ask me all kinds of really quite probing questions about possible differences between details in books 1 and 2. So I have to be pretty careful about it. I think it is vital that an author who writes fantasy works out the rules as much as possible. If you don't, if you have a book where fantasy can pretty much do anything, there are no rules, then I think ultimately the audience will sense that. They'll realize anything goes, and it won't matter so much. So Bartimaeus has got all these powers, but he is He is constrained by some pretty severe rules about what he can and can't do. And the same goes for all the other characters too. They're all kind of battling within these restrictions. And that makes it, I think, a bit more interesting and a bit more tense.
Yeah, it brings to mind one of my only criticisms about the last Lord of the Rings film.
Yeah.
Was that after a while I just felt like I couldn't follow who could do what.
Yeah.
And it bothered me that I didn't know who could do what, because, I mean, I suppose on the one hand, you're left kind of breathlessly wondering what's going to happen next.
Mm.
But in some of these kind of works, it's actually nice to feel like you're working within some kind of framework, even if the framework is a magical one.
Yes.
It's just nice to have points of reference, so you feel like you're in the midst of it. And I didn't always feel that way, for instance, with Lord of the Rings, and for that matter, a whole lot of fantasy works.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think it's quite key. And even if you're not quite sure precisely what's bothering you, you start to sense if I think it's true of other genres as well. If the makers kind of move the goalposts a little bit just to let the hero escape from a certain thing, then you know you sense this. In fact, hopefully they're going to make a movie of the book, and Miramax are working on it at the moment. And they, because I'm still writing book three of the trilogy, they sent me a list of about 60 questions about what's going to happen in book three. How does the magic work? Can you be more precise about precisely what Bartimaeus can and can't do? And a lot of the questions I really struggled with, but it helped me. I sat down and I spent a couple of weeks trying to formulate precisely what the rules were, so that it helps them as they work on the screenplay. But it's also going to help me as I try and tie the whole trilogy together in book three.
Hmm. We're speaking with author Jonathan Stroud. Just a couple more quick questions, if you have time.
Of course, yeah, no problem.
One of the things, of course, that's interesting is that you have set out to write a trilogy, and these first two books are both pretty substantial in size. And of course, we're talking about when we're talking about a trilogy like this, it's a real epic canvas on which you're working. Talk to us about the special challenges which are involved in constructing something like this. I mean, sort of a Wagner ring cycle, but three parts instead of four. But, I mean, a big, big story that somehow has to hold together. Aside from the obvious, what are the challenges of that?
Well, I think just with working on the sequel, The Golem's Eye, that's the first time I've ever tried to do a sequel, and there are considerable dangers attached to doing it. One of the things is if the first book has been successful and that you've got characters that you enjoy and which your readers have enjoyed, the temptation is to then pretty much replicate that all of what you've done in book one in book two and just do a very similar kind of structure. I think if you do that, ultimately you're leading to decreasing returns. I think it's necessary to try and move. It's almost necessary to try and treat book two as a separate book, which is unique, as well as being part of this trilogy. So you've got to have the continuity. You've got to have the same characters doing sort of familiar things that everyone will appreciate. But you've also got to somehow ring the changes and make it a substantial book in its own right. And in book two, one of the things I tried to do was to introduce a third main character, a young girl called Kitty, who doesn't appear much in book one at all. But in book two, she really comes to the forefront. She's a commoner who has no magical power, and she strongly resents the magicians and the genies and the other spirits. And so she her perspective gives us a completely different look on the world of the first book. And so hopefully that makes book two quite different from book one, but nonetheless it's part of a continuity. And in book three, which I'm doing now, I'll have to think of a way of again just slightly shifting it so that for the readers it remains fresh.
One thing you said almost made it sound like you didn't start out writing a trilogy.
Well, when I very first started, I didn't know what I was doing at all. I just started writing about 50 pages of the book, and I started writing Kitty's story for book one, and it didn't take me long to realize that it was going to be too difficult to put Nathaniel, Kitty, and Bartimaeus all into book one. So in the end, after probably about a month or two of writing, I shifted Kitty's story into the second book of the trilogy, and I actually did a chapter plan of all three books. So quite early on, I knew I was going to do three books, but the precise details, especially of book three, I have to say, were not fully thought out in my mind.
Mm. Why a trilogy? Why not book four and five, or for that matter, why not the Hardy Boys and 30 books?
I think there's a reason why the trilogy is. A lot of people do trilogies. I think that there is a satisfactory structure to be had there, that you can set things up in the beginning. You've got a middle section where you can kind of change things around and add new influences, which I've hopefully done with my book. And then in book three, you can hopefully tie things together, get the threads, and bring it to a satisfactory conclusion. I think there's quite a natural story arc that you can construct in those three. If you keep on going ad infinitum, the danger is that you're going to get this diminishing returns thing. You know, can you truly sustain a narrative indefinitely? And I think that would be very difficult. I mean, it's always possible to bring characters back in another time, or there would be other ways around it. But at the moment, I'm very happy with just doing three and then having a rest.
Right. Very good. Well, you've certainly earned a rest. As you go on to a second book that is released, was it maybe a year and a half after the first one, or was it a couple of years? What was the difference in release date between?
It's been 1 year. The last one came out around about this time last year.
Oh, I think I'm getting confused, because if I remember correctly, the story is picked up maybe 2 years after
right.
the first book.
Yes, no, you're right. There's more of a jump within the story than there was in the publication.
Right. But do you write each of these books now in the trilogy pretty much for the same reader? You're not making any kind of conscious decision to write for a slightly older reader, or to fashion slightly more complex stories, or do you just sort of let it unspool the way it's going to unspool?
That's a good, interesting question. I certainly not consciously. I'm not consciously thinking, right, I'm going to make book two more difficult than book one, or the same with book three. I think, again, because I'm trying to do something slightly different with each book, there are going to be differences, and it will be interesting to see whether, if I come back in a year's time and ask the kids which of the two books so far they've enjoyed most, it'll be interesting to see whether there is any kind of age difference there, whether the younger kids prefer the first book or not. But no, I wouldn't consciously want to alter it, because I know that, generally speaking, kids of 9 and 10 are going to pick up in a couple of years. They can pick up books 1, 2, and 3, read them all in a month, and they've got to be able to read all three in quick succession.
Mm. Do you write with an international audience of readers in mind, as I read your book, it doesn't strike me as particularly British, and I'm assuming and actually know for a fact that you have young readers aplenty here in the United States,
yeah,
for instance.
Right, for sure, yeah.
But is that something you very consciously think about crafting a story that will connect with a wide range of young people?
Yes, but when I first started writing, I didn't really have any kind of international audience in mind. I was just trying to create something that entertained me, and I guess in a way that's the key, really. I was looking to write something that would have entertained me as a child, and would also entertain me if I found it on a shelf now as an adult. And so I was always aware that the books might well appeal to children and to adults. That was certainly my hope. To be honest, as I've gone around America, I've found absolutely no difference in the response between the American kids and the English kids. And I'm sure that if I went across to another country and I spoke the language sufficiently, I would see that the kids in Japan or in Spain or wherever would all approach the book pretty similarly. Also, I don't think there's much difference internationally, especially now that there's the age of all these fantasy books and fantasy films, which are crossing cultures.
Exactly, very much so. That does bring to mind once again a certain bespeckled young boy. And let me just ask you, has that Harry Potter legacy been of any influence to you, or maybe a cautionary tale of any kind? I mean, do you feel like, as an author, that has taught you any lessons of any kind, really? Or have you really maybe tried to go the other way and really tried not to think too much about that phenomenon as you've crafted these own wonderful books of your own?
Well, I think anybody who's writing fantasy at the moment lives in the shadow of the sort of Harry Potter achievement. And generally speaking, we're all very grateful for it because Harry Potter has done so well and has achieved so much media interest that there's a very healthy environment for other books of children's fiction and certainly other books of fantasy. So, you know, I'm always very... I always feel sort of very good towards Harry Potter in that way. But in the same way that Tolkien, I think, has done it for an earlier generation, you have to kind of live in the shadow of these great works, and you have to do something that's unique to yourself. If you set out to copy or to if you are unduly influenced by any of these things, then in the end you're going to create something that's fairly short-lived. So you have to be true to what inspires you, but nonetheless, you know, you take advantage of the environment of the present day. And at the moment, it's an absolutely great time to be writing children's books.
Absolutely, I'm sure you are excited at the prospect of this trilogy coming to life on the screen. Is that also a frightening prospect at all? Because we certainly hear sometimes about how the transfer to the screen is not an entirely successful one, or one that doesn't always make the author particularly happy. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, when I signed the contract with Miramax a couple of years ago, at the time I was sort of anxious, and I was told, "Yes, you know, you are signing over your the control, and they can pretty much do what they want with the story." But as I thought to myself then, and I still think now, if the book is successful as a book, then the filmmakers are going to want to do something that is as faithful as possible to the story. Otherwise, they're going to get children and adults coming to see the film who won't like it because it'll be too different. And I know for a fact that because I've spoken with the screenwriter and with people at Miramax that they are doing their darndest to be as faithful as possible to the essence of the book. Obviously, there are going to be changes because you're turning a 500-page book into a 2-hour movie. You can't bring everything over. You've got to cut and you've got to winnow down. And as long as they're faithful to the key relationships between the central characters, then I'm very confident that they will do a very exciting adaptation of it.
Well, it's certainly exciting material with which they get to work. That's for sure. This is a marvelously written book. Again, the second book in the Bartimaeus trilogy. It's called The Gollum's Eye. I have mislaid my info. Oh yes. Oh, it's published by Miramax, isn't it? Miramax Kids is the publisher.
Yeah, Miramax Hyperion, that's right.
Very good. And Jonathan Stroud, what a pleasure and honor to speak with you about your oh-so-successful career. And we certainly wish you the very best in completing the third book of this trilogy and in whatever writing exploits you explore after that. And we thank you for joining us today on The Morning Show.
Thanks very much, Greg.
And I wanted to offer a little 2022 update on one matter which came up late in the interview, in which Mr. Stroud talks about the film rights to the books being purchased by Miramax. And indeed, Harvey Weinstein did purchase the film rights, envisioning these books perhaps serving as a replacement for The Lord of the Rings as Miramax's fantasy film franchise. Work was begun on scripts, but ultimately Harvey Weinstein left Miramax with his brother to start their own company, which in effect left these films in limbo and ultimately never made. My understanding is another company has purchased the film rights to the Bartimaeus books, and there is every possibility that they may still be adapted for the screen. As far as I know, no films yet have appeared.
It is coming up on 9 o'clock on this Monday, June 27th, WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News, and classical music on your gateway to public radio. At 9:01, we'll join Wisconsin Public Radio, NPR for their news, and then we join Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming. Right now, let's check the forecast.